from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Andy Weir self-published The Martian on his personal website back in 2011. A publisher snapped up the rights, and his pet project made it to New York Times bestseller list and went on to become an Oscar-nominated film starring Matt Damon. His new book, Artemis, takes place on a lunar colony where a smuggler named Jazz embarks on a dangerous heist. Weir joins us to talk about Artemis, researching space exploration, and his life since The Martian launched into fame. That's up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Andy Weir is with us this hour here in studio. He's the author of the bestseller book called The Martian, which was turned into a movie starring Matt Damon. His new book is called Artemis, and it has to do with a colony on the moon, a lunar colony, and a smuggler by the name of Jazz who embarks on a rather dangerous heist. And good to have you with us. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's see where to begin. Let's begin with... You had this amazing success. You didn't have to do this one online like you did with the first one.
That's right? True, yeah.
And again, there's a lot of research here, and I want to get into it. I know the listeners, especially scientific listeners who love to hear about the sort of stuff that you did in The Martian and do now with the moon, will be fascinated to hear. What gave birth to this? Because you did, I know you did a whole book before this. You were under contract, right?
Yeah. So after The Martian and before Artemis, I worked on a book. That was the working title was Jack, Z-H-E-K. And I got about 70,000 words into that. I spent about a year on it. And it was a more space opera, like classic sci-fi, like, you know, aliens and telepathy and faster than light travel and stuff like that. And when I was about at the 70,000 word mark, for reference, The Martian is 100,000 words, I was looking at it and I realized, oh no, this sucks. I realized that I couldn't figure out how to fix it.
Those are the exact words you heard in your consciousness?
Yes, that's exactly what I said to myself. And, well, when you're a writer, all you can do is try to write a book that you yourself would enjoy reading, right? That's like, kind of rule number one. And I just had to give it an honest assessment and said, like, if I were reading this book, I would have given up and put it down by now.
So instead, you went off and you sort of shot to the moon, so to speak, or did a moonshot. Why create not only a female voice, which you did in this book, as opposed to the book that many people read and the movie that many people saw about Mark Watney, but why a Saudi Muslim woman?
Well, she's actually not a Muslim. She's
Muslim by birth, yeah.
Well, I mean, Islam is, you know, that's a religion, not an ethnicity, right? But she's she is Saudi. And ethnically an Arab woman. Her father is a devout Muslim, but she did not adopt the faith.
But you adopted a woman's voice. Why?
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So what happened was when I first came up with the first thing I did for Artemis was I wanted to design the city itself. I wanted to get the setting solid in my mind and well-defined and internally consistent before I worked on story or characters. And the reason I did that is because readers are a lot smarter than they know they are. They can smell when you've adjusted the setting for the convenience of the story. So I wanted to have the setting be kind of rock solid and then write a story that takes place in it. So once I had Artemis designed and all set up, then I started coming up with stories. And I came up with an idea for a story and kind of outlined it and laid it out. And Jazz was a very tertiary character. I just needed a character to be like a lovable rogue kind of smuggler type for two or three scenes tops. And Artemis is a very international city, so I picked a country kind of at random that I hadn't used yet, and so I picked Saudi Arabia. And then I said, and we'll make the character a woman just because, why not?
And you wrote a heist novel, a thriller, and sort of a caper novel, crime caper?
Yeah. Well, what happened was Jazz was originally a very tertiary character. Anyway, so that story concept, I didn't like it. So I ditched it and moved on to another one. And I took elements from the first one that I liked and put them together. And Jazz was more prominent in the second Rev, but still not the main character. I didn't like the second Rev either, but I realized that Jazz was an interesting character, so I designed a plot around her. And by that time, she was so cemented in my mind as a Saudi woman that if I'd tried to change her into something I was more familiar with, my imagination would have just rebelled at me. So then I found myself writing a first-person narration from, a Saudi woman's point of view. So, yeah, that may have been made things a little harder for me than they needed to be.
But you already had your world created. And,
yeah.
You know, this is like a fictional world, like a great philosopher Immanuel Kant writes about. You know, you create a world and it exists unto itself. And there's a strange sense here in immersing yourself into this world that you've created. You've got kind of spheres and bubbles and I don't know what else we call them, maybe domes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that are bases, essentially. I mean, one's suburban, one's industrial, one's working class, more, I suppose, have-nots and all of that. I mean, in a sense, kind of microcosmically, like so many of the big cities here in the world we live in.
Yeah. Well, I just tried to – I based Artemis – because Artemis is a tourist destination, that's its economy. It's about 40 kilometers from the Apollo 11 landing site, so mainly what it is tourism. I based the layout of the city on, well, first off, the realities of building a city on the moon, and then second off...
Did you have a Caribbean place in mind?
Yes, that's exactly it. Not any specific place, but I based it on Caribbean resort towns and kind of how they work out. So you have your kind of really high-end hotels and whatnot, for the tourists, and then the more austere conditions for the people who live and work there. And I just kind of like tried to have the city develop the way that I thought would be realistic.
And people are going to go to the moon like they're going to go to the Caribbean.
Yeah, it's more expensive.
Casinos there too on the moon.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Casinos and high-end hotels and plays and shows and brothels and whatever you're looking for.
There's also, and this gets into your scientific research, which is always impressive. I mean, you're a self-confessed nerd and
absolutely
all that. But there's also this mineral on the moon, which can be actually, it is in your novel, taken and turned into aluminum by smelting.
Yes, absolutely. It's if I were to have invented a fictional planet that had anorthite all over the place, people would call me out for just making things too easy on the main characters. People would say, are you kidding me? No, that's just way too convenient. I don't believe it. But in reality, that's what's going on. The moon is like riddled with this mineral called anorthite. I mean, it's the most common. If you just pick up a rock off the ground in the lunar highlands, that's the bumpy areas as opposed to the smooth areas. If you just pick up a rock off the ground, odds are very likely that it's going to be anorthite.
And you can get oxygen from it.
Well, anorthite is a mineral that's made of four elements. It's aluminum, silicon, calcium, and oxygen. And with a smelting process, you separate it out into those base elements, and now you have aluminum to build your city and oxygen to fill it.
So how convenient. You don't have to import.
It's incredibly convenient. It's like the moon is just begging us to colonize it. The moon is made of moon bases, just some assembly required.
I also learned, I maybe knew this back in my... earlier incarnation when I was much younger, but you can take silicon and oxygen and make glass.
Yes, that's yet another benefit of anorthite because you anorthite has a ridiculous amount of oxygen in it. It's like for every two aluminum atoms, there's eight oxygen atoms in there. And so you end up liberating so much oxygen, you'll just have it to spare. You'll be able to use it to make rocket fuel for return trips. You'll be able to use it to breathe. You'll be able to use it to mix with silicon to make glass, if you like.
And would you come up with the idea, or the calculation, I should say, that a one-way ticket would be about, what, $33,000?
Well, that'd be a one-way ticket, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't include any of the price, the cost of living in Artemis, that'd just be getting there. But yeah, I did a whole long economic analysis where I don't want to bore your listeners too much with it, so I'll just kind of summarize. Basically, I mapped the commercial space industry onto the commercial airline industry and said, what would the ticket prices be driven down to if the space industry spent the same percentage of its revenue on fuel that the airline industry does?
You're doing a lot of Elon Musk's work ahead of time for him, aren't you?
Well, I always like to remind people that I'm an enthusiast and not an expert. So, you know, the folks at SpaceX and Blue Origin and, you know, they've all done this math and economic analysis probably a lot more accurately than I would have.
But, you know, when you do this kind of a novel, you have to ask yourself some essential questions, not only how you're going to get oxygen there, but, you know, how would the colony proceed and on what kind of trajectory and all that. Even in terms of food, I mean, you know, I don't think it would be all that, shall I say, enhancing or inviting to be eating algae, even if it's flavored, but that's where you get into the food, the nutrients.
Yeah, absolutely. Artemis is too small to have things like wheat fields and, you know, corn fields and stuff like that. If you make enough money, you can, of course, just eat food that's imported from Earth. But if you're less, if you don't have that much money, if you're the lower class, you have to eat food that's made locally. And what that is this algae. It's chlorella algae is the actual name of the species.
You call it gunk.
They call it gunk, yeah. And that's their nickname for it. And I've had some. I was ambushed. I was on a live like internet broadcast, and they brought me some. They're like, "Here you go. Here's some chlorella algae, the stuff you talk about in your book." And you just kind of
Tasted it before?
I had never tasted it before, and it does taste awful. I can assure you, it tastes like well, you know how like seaweed tastes good, you know, when you're having Japanese food. I don't know if you like Japanese food. I do. The nori, the seaweed, tastes pretty good. Well, imagine that, but like 100 times more that flavor, and it stays in your mouth for a good 10 minutes after you've finished eating it, and no matter what else you put in your mouth, you're still tasting that seaweed. So the reason they use algae, though, is because algae can be grown in vats in a very small volume of space, and also chlorella has this really cool feature where the frequencies of light that it gets and the nutrients that are in the bath determine how much energy the chlorella stores in sugars and how much it puts into making proteins. So by controlling those vats, you can make stuff that is perfectly nutritionally balanced for humans.
Talking to Andy Weir, he's the author of The Martian and now a new book called Artemis, and he'll be speaking tomorrow at Books, Inc. in Mountain View at 7 p.m. Now he's here with us, and we'll have you, our listeners, join us in an opportunity to speak directly with Andy, who's here with us in studio, who's done a lot of research on this. I mean, I learned about EVA suits. I didn't know anything about EVA suits.
Yeah, it's usually said EVA. The letters are usually said separately. Yeah, I mean, those Apollo astronauts who are bouncing around when you see them in the footage, they're wearing EVA suits.
Yeah, and hamster balls?
Hamster balls is, I made that up for the book. That's not a real thing.
But it's plausible.
It's very plausible. It's just basically a thick, flexible polymer material that is airtight, and you get inside and then inflate it, and then you can wander around on the moon like a hamster in a hamster ball. And you have a backpack on that they call a scurry pack, and that backpack deals with all the life support and stuff, keeping the temperature reasonable and dealing with the oxygen CO2 mixture in the air inside your little hamster ball. And then you just run around, do what you want.
Why did you want to make this lunar colony so multicultural?
Well, it wasn't a deliberate goal on my part. It was actually more just, again, I tried to just kind of set things in motion and figure out what would be the emergent behavior. And Artemis is it's a frontier town. Think of like America in the 1830s or something like that. It's if you can afford to get here, then you're welcome to be here. And so people go there. There's a certain personality type that can be found across all cultures, here and there, spotted in amongst all of humanity, of people who are attracted to the idea of going out to the farthest edge of civilization and trying to make a life there. And so Artemis is peopled with that kind of folks.
It's not going to be Andy Weir, though, because you're afraid to fly, right?
That's right. I don't even like getting on a commercial airplane, and there's just no way you'd get me into space or Mars or the moon or anything. I write about brave, adventurous people. I'm not one of them. I like being, you know, 10 minutes away from emergency medical care and being able to order pizza.
It's a brave adventure also to write a second novel, especially when you've had so much success with the first novel.
Yeah.
And I mean, in many respects, for example, some people were saying, I mean, there have been some good reviews of this, but the Chronicle kind of bashed you. And didn't, you got a letter from some guy. It sounded like it was maybe filled with envy, saying, you know, this didn't deserve the prize that it got. And you get all that kind of stuff when you're out there and getting plaudits of any kind or a success of any kind.
Yeah. I mean, so with The Martian, I had such a dream come true experience where, like, almost every single review was overwhelmingly positive. It sold really well. Everybody liked it. It got made into a movie. Everybody liked the movie. I mean, I had this dream scenario. Now with Artemis, I'm finally starting to see what it's actually like to be a writer, you know, where I've got, it's doing well. It's getting predominantly good reviews. It gets some bad reviews, and some of the bad reviews, you know, what I try to do is I'm looking for the information that I can use to make myself a better writer. And so it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a demographic of people who just hate it because it's a man writing a woman. And they just won't accept it no matter what.
Tell them to read Madame Bovary.
I have to kind of ignore them. But then there's another group of people who are just making critical analysis of my use of a female voice and making very good points. And so I have to. It's really hard to separate, you know, the people who are just like, oh, you're a man, you shouldn't write a woman, from the people who are like, here's exactly like kind of where it didn't quite work. And stuff like that.
There's another element, though, and that is you're a software engineer. You're a self-described nerd and everything.
Absolutely.
And you know, writing novels is a craft. You got to have presumably rounded characters. You have to not only have a plot line and a movement forward and everything, but a lot of people expect and have high bars in terms of literary expectations.
Well, some of that, although I don't think anyone would accuse The Martian of being literature, right? I mean, like, Mark Watney is not a deep character. All you know about him is that he doesn't want to die. And I think, you know, you can kind of make that assumption about most people. But
you're more like this Saudi narrator of yours than
absolutely.
You are like Mark Watney.
Yeah. I'm much more like Jazz than I am Mark, because Jazz is, well,
You're greedy and a crook?
Well, not quite, but I am at age 26. I was very much like Jazz is, who is 26. And when I was her age, I was kind of like unmotivated, not meeting my potential, just making, you know, ostensibly intelligent, yet still managing to make every poor life decision a person can make. So
you still got that smart ass quality, though.
Oh, no, I've got the smart ass quality. That'll never leave. But hopefully I make better life decisions now.
Well, there's also, you know, you can be a funny writer. And obviously you enjoy being a funny writer.
I do. That's critical to me that the humor be there, especially in a book where, well, both books have a lot of scientific exposition where I need to explain things to the reader about how this science works, how that science works, and so on. And if I don't inject a lot of humor in there, then it becomes a really dull read when you're getting through that exposition. So the kind of first-person smart-ass narration has worked really well for me to get information across and make the reader enjoy acquiring the information.
Well, let me find out what our listeners have to say or ask Andy Weir again, our guest, following up his bestseller, The Martian, with the launch of Artemis. And some of you may have some thoughts about colonizing the moon. As I said, one can't escape the name of Elon Musk in that whole equation. But there's a lot here in terms of what he conceives and the research he's done about that. And it's a story. It's a story that a lot of people have really enjoyed. And frankly, I enjoy it to a great degree. Let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available. And you can ask questions or comments if you saw The Martian or if you have some thoughts about that as a movie or, for that matter, as a novel. Ridley Scott did the movie, and it was quite a success. In fact, got a nomination for an Oscar.
Seven,
that's right. And there's, by the way, audio, I realize, of Artemis with Rosario Dawson, no less, doing Jazz's voice.
Very
excited. Invite she listeners with questions or comments. You can join us now, and we invite your involvement in the program. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us with any questions or comments you might have for Andy Weir. If you'd like to talk with him about, well, colonizing the moon or anything else, writing a novel for that matter, 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. You can also join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but one way or another, we certainly would like to have your involvement in the program and invite you cordially to be part of the program and to participate. What'd you say about, you know, getting the moon as opposed to getting to Mars? You got a football field metaphor in that.
Yeah. Oftentimes I get asked, hey, why did you set, you know, your last book was on Mars. It seems like a step backwards to be talking about the moon. Well, The Martian was about exploration, whereas Artemis is about colonization. And I just really think we'll colonize the moon first, because if you were standing on a football field and you were at one goal line and Mars were at the other goal line, the moon would be 4 inches in front of you. That's the scale of difference that we're talking about in how far apart these bodies are from us.
Well, I don't mean to give you a crystal ball prerogative here, but, you know, the book takes place in futuristic 2080, I believe, right?
Yeah, 2084
specifically. 2084, yeah.
1984 echoes. No simile, no parallels intended on that.
No, but you say you're almost fairly certain that there will be colonization of the moon, and there's certainly been talk about it now for years. Is this kind of the timeline that you have in mind?
Well, I mean, it's a wild guess, of course. I'm shooting for basically, I think that we will colonize the moon once commercial space travel drives the price to low Earth orbit down low enough that middle class people can afford to go. Once that happens, then there'll be a space boom comparable to the airline boom of the late 40s and 50s, where it'll just be this huge multi-trillion-dollar industry. And from there will come space hotels in low Earth orbit, and then eventually moon cities for tourism.
And there are a lot of people who are ready to go. I mean, chomping at the bit to go, in fact.
Yeah, yeah, they absolutely would. If that were affordable to the middle class for like a once-in-a-lifetime vacation, I think it'd be a very profitable venture. And so businesses would sink as much money as necessary into making it happen.
Well, and they do in your novel. Really.
In the novel, they do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes sort of a new frontier possibility. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a new frontier for all kinds of profiteering of all different types. Let's bring one of our callers on here. We go first to Stanford. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Wonderful. My quick question was, what was your inspiration for writing both novels?
Well, for the Martian, in both cases, I started off by making a setting, effectively. For the Martian, I was sitting around imagining how we could do a manned mission to Mars, how to get the crew there, how to keep them alive when they are there, how to get them back. And then I started coming up with, well, what do you do if this breaks? What do you do if that breaks? What do you do if these two things break at the same time? And I realized that the increasingly desperate things you'd have to do to stay alive might make a good story. So I created an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of them. And so that's where the Martian came from. For Artemis, I said I want to make a story about humanity's first city that's not on Earth. And after some quick research, I realized that would pretty much have to be on the moon. I had to come up with a reason why it would be on the moon, and so that was tourism, and it grew from there. Once I had the city, then I'm like, oh, interesting. We have a frontier city with its own, you know, with its own kind of internal economy, a completely unregulated currency. I see all sorts of opportunities for a crime novel here.
They probably have Bitcoin on the moon, don't they?
Well, their currency in Artemis is called slugs, and it's just it's not a cryptocurrency.
Andy Weir with us in the studio, and again, we do welcome your involvement in the program. If you have thoughts, I'd particularly like to hear from listeners who have some thoughts about moon colonization or the living on the moon in the future, if it seems plausible, or if you have questions about just how likely it is, or some thoughts about it, please feel free to join us if you want to talk about The Martian. Andy, we did not have the privilege of having you on to talk about The Martian. I did an interview with you on stage, if you may recall.
But, yes.
So this is an opportunity for people who saw that movie or have some thoughts about that as well to join us. Talking also about the excursion of writing novels, which in itself is a whole odyssey. Please feel free to join the program. Toll free, you can do that now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Join the program. I'm Michael Krasny. Here's what's coming up tomorrow on Forum. At 10, historian Elizabeth Cobbs will join us to talk about her new book, The Hello Girls, which is based on the experiences of the first women to serve in the U.S. Army Signal Corps during World War I. Then at 10:30, we speak to Bay Area author Joyce Maynard about her new memoir, The Best of Us, in which she describes her marriage at age 59 to her first true partner and the couple's struggle with his fatal illness. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're @KQEDForum, and you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Andy Weir. He's the author of the bestseller The Martian and has a new book out called Artemis, which is also a novel, and he'll be speaking tomorrow, December 12th at Books, Inc. in Mountain View at 7 p.m. And I'm going to go right to calls and emails here and remind you can join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And I was saying a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but not necessarily, to Andy during the break that maybe he could just go through the whole solar system, do a novel about one of the, well, I guess the livable moon from Jupiter or Venus or whatever. But it's interesting. You're thinking now, getting ahead of ourselves here a little bit, more stories on Artemis.
Well, that would be that's what I've been thinking when people ask me, oh, what do you want to write next? Well, I'd like to write another story that takes place in the city of Artemis, but not with the same main character. So, I mean, Jazz is the protagonist of Artemis. She would be an important character in the story, but she would not be the protagonist. I would love for Artemis to be a shared setting, well, a common setting for a lot of my stories. And then, because I love that when I'm as a reader. So like, for instance, Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, all these different stories take place in the same setting. And the setting just seems so rock solid in your mind after you read those that suspension of belief takes zero effort. It's awesome.
Well, you could do what one of the greatest American writers, William Faulkner, did. You know, you got Yaknapatawpha County and called it my postage stamp of reality. And
then yes.
I just kept having genealogy, lineage, you know, one generation after another, or going back to other previous generations. Jazz's name is Jasmine Becerra, by the way.
Yeah.
Let me go to our callers, and let's begin with Howard. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Andy. I have two kids, 11 and 13, boy and a girl, and we love The Martian, first of all. My son especially appreciated the duct tape actually being part of like a fix-it problem out in space and, you know, the reality of it. He plays a lot of Minecraft, but he's looking for more reality. And I couldn't help but ask the question, would you consider doing like a VR 3D game of Artemis where kids could build the world and interact internationally, maybe interstellarly? I don't know.
yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to kind of like sign a piece of paper giving a company the rights to do that. But I myself, I want to concentrate on writing, and I've kind of, that's what I want to put my time into.
There are some entrepreneurs probably in Silicon Valley right now who would be contacting you or would like to be contacting you about that. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
How old did you say your kids were, Howard?
My kids are 11 and 13.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they like The Martian. I'm glad I could expose your children to a bunch of profanities.
Yeah. And the whole, you know, growing the potatoes, is we talk about it all the time. And you know, it's the answer to everything. You can just do it and poop.
Yep, potatoes.
Yeah, couldn't do it on the moon, right? You can't grow potatoes on the moon.
Oh, well, you can. It's
can
just
you?
They were, yeah, in Artemis, it's they can't grow enough potatoes to feed 2,000 people.
Yeah. Let me thank you for the call, Howard. Let me get to some more callers here. Michael joins us. Michael, you're on.
Thank you. Mr. Weir, I'm writing. I'm a first-time writer. I've got a novel in 120,000 characters.
That's all?
Or words, 120,000 words. my main characters are women. And that wasn't my choosing. They chose me. But I've read it, and I don't like their voice. And so, advice, or how did you get into a female voice?
Well, first off, I don't think anyone's going to be giving me an award for my, female voice. I think all I wanted to do was do it well enough that female readers aren't completely knocked out of the story by the voice. Like, if they can, every now and then, if they kind of raise an eyebrow and go like, well, that didn't seem quite right, but we're going to let that pass, then I call that a win.
Didn't you have some of your women friends read it, though?
I did, though. That's what I did was I gave my manuscript to every woman in my circle of trust, everyone I knew wouldn't throw it up on the Pirate Bay or something. And like my mother, my girlfriend, my editor is a man, but his boss is a woman. My editor's assistant and the copy editor was a woman. I told her, hey, I know that they usually tell you not to comment on the story, but I do want you to comment on the story. Please tell me anywhere you think the female voice doesn't fit. And I took all their feedback and I made changes. So basically, that was the only thing I could think of to try to strengthen the female voice.
You know, there's a wonderful story about Tennessee Williams. He wrote Streetcar Named Desire, among many other plays. And
Stella.
Somebody said to him, how did you manage to create
a woman who was so believable as Blanche DuBois. And his response was, "My dear, I am Blanche DuBois." Now, I thought about Flaubert before because he said, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi," you know.
Yeah. Well, jazz
is
not,
me. You've made the analogy before, your younger self. Yeah.
Yeah, jazz is very much my younger self, but there's nothing. Let me put it this way. The personality traits that jazz has and her many flaws that match mine for my younger self, there's nothing gender specific about them. And so there's nothing male or female about those aspects of her that I put in. So I didn't have any special advantage on writing a believable female. And it remains to be seen if I did write a believable female. All I really want is to write an entertaining female.
What about that idea, though, about writing a well-rounded character? I mean, then you get into some things about the craft of a novel. There's a famous book by E.M. Forster called Aspects of the Novel, where he says you got two kinds of characters. You got flat characters and round characters. The round characters have more dimension to them, more nuance, and so forth. So did you feel you were writing a rounded character?
Well, I certainly gave it a try with jazz. That was a deliberate thing I did. I want to always be getting better as an author. And of course, after The Martian's unexpected success, I had imposter syndrome galore. And so I'm like, well, I better actually learn how to write here at some point. And so I tried to make Jazz a much deeper, more complex character. She has a lot of flaws. She has, a lot of complexity to her. And so, yeah, that's something I'm really trying. But I don't have the time, the space in the book to make every single character that deep. So, or at least I don't have the writing skill to do that yet.
Well, when you speak about imposter syndrome galore, I mean, there are wages of, people speak about the wages of fame. I mean, did you suffer some of that at all?
Well, I found that the southwest corner of my office is the best place for cowering and whimpering. It gets good light in the morning. Yeah, no, of course. I was really worried about it, writing Artemis, because I was just worried that people, say like, oh, Andy Weir, yeah, he wrote one good book and then you can ignore everything else. You know, that's what I'm afraid of. And I was talking to a writer friend of mine about that, and he said, like, yeah, that never goes away. You can be working on your 27th novel, and the previous 26 were all number one on the New York Times bestsellers. You're still going to feel exactly like that. So just kind of make your peace with that.
He's absolutely right. I'm speaking of someone who's interviewed a lot of authors, and they say he's pretty much ditto that. If you'd like to join us with Andy Weir, you can do it now at 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org. And here's Sharon from Orinda. Morning.
Good morning. I loved The Martian. I thought it was a wonderful book, and I really loved the tautness of it and the suspense of it and your main character. I have to say, piggybacking on your last bunch of comments there, I really didn't find Jazz a believable female protagonist.
Okay.
Her dialogue just really actually, as you said, Mark, just kind of took me out of the story. I thought, I don't know, it didn't work for me, but
okay.
I loved The Martian.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you liked The Martian. And yeah, I mean, I'm taking the feedback of, there are two kinds of writers, the ones who read all the reviews and then the ones who lie and claim they don't read all the reviews. And so I am paying attention to what everybody says in the hopes of kind of honing my craft and getting better at it.
You said earlier that... I said earlier, actually, that you did get some good reviews, but how do the bad reviews affect you? Or do they? I mean, maybe you can be constructive and learn from them, but they get in your viscera, don't they?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it hurts my feelings, but I try to, this is my profession, so I need to kind of, I can sulk for a little bit, but I do that quietly, and then I try to read them and find out, okay, What can I learn from this when I get a bad review? And some of the bad reviews I just have to ignore.
That's a good attitude, though. Yeah, so, I can learn from this, and, I'll sulk, but I can learn from this.
Yeah. It's all about separating the wheat from the chaff. Some bad reviews are just, not everybody's going to like your book. And some bad reviews are just, this is not a person who's receptive to this plot idea. It's just, there was no way that plot was going to make this person happy. And I'm like, okay, well, it didn't work for that person. But it's when the execution of the plot didn't work out, or when they didn't like a character or they didn't like aspects of a character, that I really try to pay attention and see, Am I seeing trends among many, many reviews that all say the same thing? That's what I need to look into and try to find ways to get better.
But a whole continuum of responses goes with the territory of
yep.
being a novelist. It's like a novel is almost like a Rorschach for people, you know, and some of them get out of it things that you hadn't even imagined they could get out of it, that they love or that they hate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way it is. Let me ask you, though. Do you miss being a software engineer? You're a full-time writer now?
Yeah, I write full-time now. And before I was a writer, I was a software engineer for 25 years. And I do miss certain parts of being an engineer. What I miss mostly is just having an office that I go to in the morning. I miss just, you know, going into work in the morning, grabbing a cup of coffee, seeing my coworkers, my teammates, and saying, hey, how you doing? Hey, what'd you do last night? Hey, how's your dog? I heard he was sick. Is he better? You know, just the social aspect of working in an office. And also I really enjoy being part of a team. Like, so as an engineer, you're usually on a team with other engineers. And so there'd be four or five of us working on a product. And we'd be working on the problem together. And so that was kind of fun. As a writer now, I'm a pretty extroverted guy. But now as a writer, I go down to my office, which is in my home. And then I sit alone at my computer all day.
And you write every day?
I try to, although lately I'm not writing at all because of the promotional stuff for Artemis. I'm spending a lot of time going to and fro, and so I just don't have any time to write at all right now.
Do you like that side of the author's role?
Oh, no, I absolutely hate it. I can't stand the constant travel and stuff like that. And also, as a guy who's afraid of flying, I'm not a big fan of the travel and... you know, I've got a nice hotel and I've got a nice house. And so I'm kind of sick of staying in hotels all the time.
Let me read some comments here. Here's a tweet, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. Listener says, I enjoyed Artemis very much, but as someone who grew up with Mercury and Gemini, your use of EVA for the suits drove me nuts.
Probably because they think of EVAs as being actually like floating outside of a spacecraft. Although to that tweeter, I would say that they were called EVAs when the Apollo astronauts exited their vehicle to walk on the moon.
Extravehicular
activity
yeah. For the spacewalks. Yeah. Let me read some more comments and questions here, and you can add your own by emailing us forum at kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Joe writes, moon colonies will not be built by people, but by artificial intelligence robots and then occupied by people.
But I would agree with that, except for the part where you say artificial intelligence, because since the moon is only 1.8 light seconds away, the robots could be controlled with reasonably good response time by humans on Earth. So there is no need to make artificial intelligence when you have full on human intelligence. But I do believe the first parts of Artemis would have been built by robots. However, remember, this takes place in a world where it's not that expensive to get humans to the moon. It doesn't cost billions of dollars. It costs tens of thousands of dollars. So at some point, it becomes cheaper. You know, the basic infrastructure and the large, broad sweeps of building, like, oh, make 50, like, big girders and stack them up over there. That's the sort of thing robots can do. But when you get to the fine manipulation work, eventually it will be cheaper to send a human there than it will be to make a robot and send it there.
We've been talking a couple of times about Elon Musk, who, of course, has said he has plans where the moon is concerned and colonizing and
sure.
all that. But he's also on record, I think, as saying that there's, to him, artificial intelligence is more frightening, more scary than just about anything, including, you know, Kim Jong-un or ISIS.
Well, there's the general fear of the, you know, the kind of singularity, basically the idea of computers getting so smart that they're smarter.
They'll take over.
And they take over. But I don't believe that's a threat. I think that once computers get smarter than us, we're just going to have a much higher quality of life. I mean, calculators are already better at doing sums than we are, and all that's done is improved our lives, right? So eventually I think we'll have just because a computer wants us to do something doesn't mean we have to do it. So eventually, I imagine, like, in the future, we'll have some AI that's way, way smarter than humans, able to analyze systems that are way, way better, and it'll say something like, raise the tax on wheat by 0.02%. And we do that. And the next thing we know, we have this huge economic boom and we don't really know why, but that computer successfully figured out that that would happen. It's kind of like AlphaGo just plays the way it plays. And then people have to analyze the heck out of
it
to figure out what it did.
Positive way of looking at an artificial intelligence as opposed to, you know, the notion that it's going to be like some Schwarzenegger movie or something.
You know? Well, you know, anytime you create a new technology thing, it can be used in bad ways and it can be used in good ways. So if you have a machine that's thousands of times smarter than a human, you could have it working on curing cancer, or you could have it working on making a targeted virus that only affect an ethnicity you don't like. So it's all about the usage of the tool, not the tool itself.
Here's Emily, who writes, I absolutely love Matt Damon as Mark Watney. I absolutely obsessed over the book, audiobook, and movie, and I hope the future jazz character is played by someone just as talented. Do you have anyone in mind who would like to see, you'd like to see play that part?
Well, I don't have any specific person in mind, although I very much want her to be someone who's the right general, like, complexion to play a Saudi woman.
Rosario Dawson would be a good choice.
Rosario Dawson would work.
Yeah.
The directors, so Fox has bought the film rights to Artemis already, and they've attached the directing duo of Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and they've made it clear that is a high priority to them. They actually want to start from Saudi Arabia itself and work outward when looking for a star.
You remove yourself entirely from the script and the movie and all
that?
Oh,
well, as the writer, your only job is to cash the check.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have any say over any part of the production. They keep me informed every now and then, but they can do whatever they like.
And the check will presumably not bounce. Here's Chris, who writes, what are some of the science fiction books that inspired you back in the day?
Well, I'm 45 years old, but I grew up reading my father's collection of science fiction. So I grew up reading baby boomer era sci-fi from the 50s and 60s and early 70s. And, you know, the kind of books where you read it and when you get to the halfway point, there's an ad for Kent cigarettes, you know, and then you continue on. And
it's
so
like
my
pulp stuff,
kind of. Yeah. They're juveniles is what they're called. And so I grew up. My holy trinity, so to speak, are Asimov, Heinlein and Clark. So those are my inspirations.
I'm not a science fiction devotee, though. I've read all those, that trinity. And I came to a conclusion a long time ago that one of the great science fiction novels was Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness. Do you know it?
I haven't read it.
It's great. Really.
Okay.
Great.
Well, on my list then.
On my list are some more listener comments. Glenn writes, I thought using pure oxygen for a breathing atmosphere was a really bad idea given the Apollo disaster. What's the science behind using it on the moon?
I get this question a lot, and it comes from a misunderstanding about how this works. Artemis's pressure, the atmospheric pressure in Artemis, is about 20% of Earth's pressure, and it's pure oxygen. This is, by the way, what they did for the Apollo missions is all we need is that partial pressure of oxygen to breathe and be comfortable. So it's actually at like 1/5 of an atmospheric pressure, which means there's the same density of oxygen molecules in the air. If you set something on fire, if you set like a piece of paper or something on fire in Artemis, it'll burn at the exact same rate that it would burn at sea level on Earth. Pure oxygen isn't what makes it a death sentence. In the case of Apollo 1, it was pure oxygen at 125% of Earth's atmospheric pressure, which is 6 times the amount of oxygen, you know, the density of oxygen molecules in the air that Artemis or sea level Earth has.
Talking to Andy Weir, and his new book is called Artemis, and here's another caller joining us from San Francisco. Kent, you're on.
Yes. I have a quick question. Is space going to be actually controlled in the future more by capitalism than democracy and governments? Thinking about SpaceX, et cetera.
Well, obviously, I can just offer my opinion on that. I think it depends on how far in the future you want to look. If you want to look at the immediate, you know, the next 100 years, then I think it's going to be largely like kind of like the law, quote unquote, that exists aboard cruise liners. It's just it's international maritime law. These laws exist, but it's very loosely controlled. And due to the Outer Space Treaty right now, no country is allowed to claim sovereignty over anything that's not on Earth. So the moon is international waters, and so is Mars. So is everything that's outside of Earth. So in the short term, it would definitely be controlled by, you know, capitalist elements that are just people out there, you know, saying, well, we're not really here to build a society. We're here to make money. And then, but if you want to look like 1,000 years into the future, then yeah, one way or another, there's going to be societies that form, and they'll either make their own rules or be controlled by some other empire from afar, you know, back on Earth or whatever.
Pretty optimistic to look 1,000 years into the future.
Hey, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe even a decade into the future with, where the atomic clock is moving closer as we're speaking here.
The doomsday clock.
Yeah. Here's Johnny who says, might it make sense to let a bunch of lobsters eat the chlorella gunk so there would be at least some tasty animal flesh growing locally in Artemis?
Well, then you'd have, then you need a lobster farm. And that might take a little bit of time. It might take a little bit of space. I don't know how long it takes a lobster to grow to maturity, but you need that amount of time. If you want people to eat lobster every day, you can do the math and work out exactly how much lobster farm you'd need, but it might be more than you want. A better idea might be chickens, because at least they make eggs and stuff. And absolutely, people in Artemis could have like small amounts of locally grown food, but that would be like a delicacy, and it's not enough to support the population of 2,000, but it might be something. It's like, ooh, you know, somebody got like 5 chickens and, you know, and they lay eggs, and I can have like fresh eggs instead of like egg powder imported from Earth.
Do you like or welcome or mind, you know, because you've described yourself with these words, geek or nerd, or those words? Those are all, you're comfortable with those?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. It's a very, very accurate depiction of me.
Because there are people who, you know, think it's almost discriminatory to use those words.
I don't. I think it's just accurate.
Robert writes, how does Artemis handle decompression on the moon?
Well, as in maintaining pressure, I guess. Within the city is made of several very large spheres that are half underground, half above ground, and they're called bubbles. And each bubble has a double-hulled system that is 6 centimeters of aluminum, then 1 meter of crushed lunar rock, basically sand, and then another 6 centimeters of aluminum. Within those hulls, they're partitioned, so there's a bunch of little triangles in that interstitial space. And like when I say little triangles, I mean 2 meters on a side. So if there is a breach in either of those two hulls, they'll know, and then they can calmly evacuate the people from that bubble into the other bubbles, seal off that bubble, repair the hull breach, and then let everyone back in. So only if both hulls get breached at the same time is there any danger of losing pressure. And that's what that meter of sand is for. If if a micrometeorite strikes it, it'll probably only break the outer hull. If a guy with a rivet gun inside Artemis isn't paying attention and accidentally blows a hole in the inner hull, then the outer hull will keep the air in, and that rivet won't be able to make it through 1 meter of crushed sand.
See, Andy, here's a liability when you write novels like you do. You get all these questions about almost asking you to peer into the future or to you become the expert of those sorts of matters. In fact, John wants to know, will the space elevator ever become a reality? Now, that's your opinion.
Space elevator will absolutely become a reality if we can ever invent a material with a tensile strength high enough to support it. So the problem becomes... if you imagine holding a rope over a cliff, an infinite cliff, and you're Superman, you can hold up as much mass as you want. You've got just a twine rope, and you hold it up over the cliff. Well, eventually, the mass of the rope that's below your hand is going to be so heavy that the rope snaps just right at your hand, right? Mm-hmm. And so you say, like, oh, okay, well, I'll use two ropes and twine them together. Well, that's no good. It'll snap at the exact same length because, yes, you have twice the surface area but you have twice the mass below you. So you say, like, okay, I'm going to use steel cable. And so that'll go further down the cliff before it breaks, but it will eventually break. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to use carbon fiber, whatever. Well, to make a space elevator, you need to have a material with a yield strength that is considerably higher than anything humanity has ever invented. So it's a question of materials technology. But if that were invented and we were able to make about 30,000 miles of it, then we could absolutely have a space elevator.
That's a big if.
That's a big if.
Yeah. Here's a listener who's a physicist who says, as a physicist, I strongly believe that life is rampant across the universe, but near all of it is extremely primitive. I also believe space travel, even to our nearest planets, is going to be a formidable challenge.
Well, I think that I definitely agree on the second half. It's a formidable challenge with our current technology to get to another planet. Absolutely. As for life being prevalent yet primitive, I think the author of that is correct in that Oh, so I believe that there is other life out in the universe, and I also believe the vast majority of it is stuff that we would consider, you know, oh, the single-celled life form. Okay, well, that's exciting, but it's not like we're going to open diplomatic, you know, relations with it.
But you're just talking about this universe.
Yeah, and but I also believe firmly that we will never beat the light barrier. I believe that we will never be able to send information or matter faster than light, no matter what clever ideas we try, that we'll never.
Or no matter how advanced the technology.
No matter how advanced, I think it's a hard rule. And so I think there could very well be an intelligent alien civilization, a billion light years away, but that's a billion years it would take to even communicate with them.
Well, we've got all these SETI things that are out there, you know, trying to at least hear from them or in some way set up some kind of communication if they're out there. Even.
So our galaxy is one of billions,
yeah.
And our entire radio footprint on that galaxy is about, 60 light years in radius, and our galaxy is 100,000 light years in radius, so we're really not affecting much.
There's a listener who tweets, when you spoke about colonization of the moon, it sounded as if you were speaking from an American perspective. How do you see colonization of the moon or other planets working on an international level, especially with some of the challenges we see today?
Well, then I would suggest that person read Artemis, because Artemis itself is owned by the Kenya Space Corporation within the book. And it's very international.
You work it out in the novel.
Yeah, it's all explained in the book, which is available now at fine bookstores and online retailers.
Well, and speaking of fine bookstores, you'll be at Books, Inc. People will want to turn out there to see Andy Weir and to talk to him. That's in Mountain View. 7 o'clock tomorrow, and so good to have you with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Again, the book is called Artemis, and it is by the novelist who gave us The Martian, which was turned into a movie starring Matt Damon. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. An hour of forum is repeated in the evening. And people ask from time to time about Sirius, because I mentioned it. It's 122 on your radio dial if you have Sirius. You can listen to us simultaneously or at night or wherever you may be on the planet. Maybe even, who knows, on the moon. Certainly welcome any thoughts you have about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear. You can email them to us, forum@kqed.org. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We'll be back with you on tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Joyce Maynard, who has written a memoir about her husband who unfortunately died, and about life with him and happiness with him and then his demise. But we'll also be talking with a woman who is the author of a new book called Hello Girls, all about women who served in the Signal Corps in World War I. That's in the 10 o'clock hour tomorrow. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.